This is the Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're on remote. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and there's a brand new book just out collecting Washington, D.C. poets from the early days of the nation's capital. And here's the editor, poet, literary historian, Kim Roberts. Hi, Kim.
Hello, Grace.
What is in this big book?
So the book is called By Broad Potomac's Shore, Great Poems from the Early Days of Our Nation's Capital. And the title comes from a poem by Walt Whitman. The book collects 132 poets who were living and working in Washington, D.C. between 1800 and 1930. 1800 is the year that the city was founded. 1930 is the beginnings of literary modernism. And I really wanted to focus on some of these earlier poets whose stories are not as well known.
Kim, whatever got into you? This is such a big project. When you were five, did you look in the mirror and say, when I grow up, I want to be a literary historian?
No one says that when they are five.
You've done such beautiful work in our city. I want everyone to know that you're the founder and longtime editor of Beltway Literary Journal, that also published Lip Smack, A History of Spoken Word Poetry. You have done so much for our city and for our nation. This is really one more contribution.
Thank you.
So how long did it take you?
Well, you know, I never know how to, where do I start to measure it? So the book, I would say once I knew it was a book, it probably took me about 4 or 5 years to compile. But you could argue that I've been doing the research for this book for over 30 years.
Oh, I believe this.
Yeah. So when I first moved to Washington, D.C., I really wanted to know who were the poets working in the city, who were the forebear poets in Washington, D.C. And that's what started all of this, was just my personal desire to have more of a connection to the a sense of place.
Well, we're going to explore that a little bit more, because you have done beyond the work of this book. But right now we want to find out what is in this. So give us a taste. Just open it up and give us a poem and let us start there.
Okay. This is a poem by T. Thomas Fortune, a writer who is actually best known as a journalist, as the editor of one of the top African-American newspapers in the country when newspapers were segregated. But he also wrote poetry, and he attended Howard University in Washington, D.C. And this is his remarkable poem, Lincoln. The waves dashed high. The thunders echoed far. The lightnings flashed into the dismal gloom. The bolts by Vulcan forged in nature's womb. And earth was shaken by the furious war. The ship of state was strained in every spar. And strong men felt that now had come their doom, and weak men scanned the dark heavens for a star to save them from a fratricidal tomb. But one, amid the strife, collected, calm, patient, and resolute, was firm, and trod the deck, defiant of the angry storm, guiding the ship, like to some ancient god. And high upon the scroll of endless fame, in diamond letters, flashes Lincoln's name.
It's very interesting, looking at the writing style throughout this book, that's usually we see a lot of rhyme, and that is a sonnet. So can you make a general statement about writing in the 19th century?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So you're right that writers were much more apt to be writing in traditional verse forms, writing with rhyme and meter. And It gives the poetry to modern ears sometimes a sort of old-fashioned sound, but it also has this timeless musicality to it that I really love.
And so easy to listen to. It is so easy.
And it did also help with memorization of poems. And you have to remember that the periods that the book covers, poetry was not something that was distanced from anyone's life. Poetry was memorized in schools. It was recited at family gatherings, at community meetings. It was published in almost every newspaper and journal. It was set to music and sung in churches and town halls. It was, poetry was a part of people's daily life in a way that it no longer is. And so, the musicality was an important part of the appeal for a wide range of readers.
We cannot imagine how central poetry was at that time. And that's why this is so important a contribution. I think now we would like to hear, let's say, two back-to-back. So they will probably be from different times in history, so we get more of a sense of the range. So give us two together.
Sure. So one of the things that I really loved doing about putting this book together was rediscovering lesser-known poets, especially women poets, working-class poets, and poets of color. And this next writer actually fits in all three of those groups. She lived during the time that we now call the Harlem Renaissance and was a part of all of the vibrancy of that movement in Washington, D.C. And I don't know why she has been forgotten, but I think her work is just as strong as the better-known Harlem Renaissance writers. She published under the name Esther Popel. She did marry, so her full name is Esther Popel Shaw. And this poem really resonates with the Black Lives Matter movement today. It is called Flag Salute. I pledge allegiance to the flag. They dragged him naked through the muddy streets, a feeble-minded black boy. And the charge? Supposed assault upon an aged woman of the United States of America. 1 mile they dragged him like a sack of meal, a rope around his neck, a bloody ear left dangling by the patriotic hand of Nordic youth, a boy of 17, and to the republic for which it stands. And then they hanged his body to a tree below the window of the county judge whose pleadings for that battered human flesh were stifled by the brutish, raucous howls of men and boys and women with their babes brought out to see the bloody spectacle of murder in the style of 33. 3,000 strong they were, one nation, indivisible. To make the tale complete, they built a fire. What matters that the stuff they burned was flesh and bone and hair and reeking gasoline? With liberty and justice, they cut the rope in bits and passed them out for souvenirs among the men and boys. The teeth, no doubt, on golden chains will hang about the favored necks of sweethearts, wives and daughters, mothers, sisters, babies too, for all.
Powerful, powerful. Give us another.
Okay. So this next poem I'm going to read is by Charlotte Fortin Grimke. And at the end of the Civil War, Union troops came back to Washington, D.C. for a long parade, the gathering of the Grand Army. They marched down Pennsylvania Avenue from the U.S. Congress building to the White House, and it took 2 days for all of the troops to pass by. Charlotte Fortin Grimke was living in D.C. at the time and witnessed this this parade and wrote this poem, The Gathering of the Grand Army. Through all the city streets, there poured a flood of human souls, eager, intent. One thought, one purpose stirred the people's blood, and through their veins its quickening current sent. The flags waved gaily in the summer air, or patient watchers neath the clouded skies. Old age and youth and infancy were there, the glad light shining in expectant eyes. And when at last our country's saviors came in proud procession down the crowded street, still brighter burned the patriotic flame, and loud acclaims leaped forth their steps to greet. And now the veterans scarred and maimed appear, and now the tattered battle flags uprise. A silence deep one moment fills the air, then shout on shout ascends unto the skies. Oh, brothers, ye have borne the battle strain, and ye have felt it through the lingering years. For all your valiant deeds, your hours of pain, we can but give to you our grateful tears. And now, with heads bowed low and tear-filled eyes, we see a silent army passing slow. For it, no music swells, no shouts arise, but silent blessings from our full hearts flow. The dead, the living, all, a glorious host, a cloud of witnesses around us press. Shall we, like them, stand faithful at our post, or weakly yield, unequal to the stress? Shall it be said, the land they fought to save, ungrateful now, proves faithless to her trust? Shall it be said, the sons of sires, so brave, now trail her scarred banner in the dust? Ah, no! Again shall rise the people's voice, as once it rose in accents clear and high. O outraged brother, lift your head, rejoice, justice shall reign, insult and wrong shall die. So shall this day the joyous promise be of golden days for our fair land in store, when freedom's flag shall float above the free, and love and peace prevail from shore to shore.
That is a very ambitious poem. And I feel if only our men from Iraq and Afghanistan and Vietnam were greeted with such a heralding, that is really an uplifting poem. And Kim, I never knew that this many women were being published until I read this book.
Yeah, well, that was one of the great surprises for me in doing this research. And so many women who did not publish their poetry in book form were still making their living as professional writers by publishing poems in newspapers. And many of the poems that I found were published, especially in some of the specialty newspapers, like the abolitionist newspapers.
Where did you go? What libraries were you to find these things? How many?
All over the place. We are very fortunate in DC to have so many research libraries available to us. So, of course, I did research at the Library of Congress, but I also worked in the Washingtoniana collection at the DC Public Library and the Washington Writers Collection at George Washington University's Gelman Library, mm-hmm. and the incomparable collection of African American history at the Howard University Library. The collection is called the Moreland Spingarn Collections.
Oh, yes.
Then I also did some traveling. I was lucky enough to get a fellowship to travel down to Emory University and work in their research library in Atlanta, Georgia. So I was going all over the place. I spent some time at the Beinecke Library at Yale University in Connecticut. And any place where I could find the original correspondence and papers. And then, of course, I also did a lot of research online. I'm lucky to be researching in a time when so many historic newspapers have been digitized.
I was going to ask about that. So how much of it is hard copy? I know you went to the letters and the newspapers, but would you say that 50% of it is available on the computer?
That's a good question. I'm really not sure. Because I started doing so much of this research before so much was digitized, some of my sources are older. I would guess that quite a lot of this has been digitized now.
We have to tell everyone the name of the book in case they forgot. It's by Broad Potomac's Shore, Great Poems from the Early Days of Our Nation's Capital. Kim Roberts is the editor, and she's telling us all about how she did it and what she did. So I see that you mentioned Howard University, which is, of course, one of America's historical Black colleges, and you have a poem by Kelly Miller. We all know that he's the father of our beloved May Miller, Washington poet we knew so well. So read us what Kelly Miller wrote.
Sure. So Kelly Miller was a dean at Howard University and just such an influential presence on that campus. He's much better known for his nonfiction, but he did, a well-educated person of that time, he did write occasional poems. And my favorite of his is included in the anthology. I love its turn at the end. This is called The Cat. I hate a cat. The very sight of feline form evokes my wrath. When e'er one goes across my path, I shiver with instinctive fright. And yet there is one little kit I treat with tender kindliness, the fondled pet of my darling Bess, for I love her and she loves it. In earth beneath, as heaven above, it satisfies the reasoning that those who love the selfsame thing must also one another love. Then, if our Father loveth all mankind, of every clime and hue, who loveth him must love them too. It cannot otherwise befall.
There's the Christian ethic we see throughout the book, wouldn't you say?
Yes. Well, one of the ways that poems were regularly disseminated was at religious meetings and in religious journals. And there was this strong feeling that poetry, because it could engage emotions, was one of the best ways to try and sway people's minds. And so throughout century plus that I cover in this book, you see again and again poets taking on moral issues and trying to sway readers to a particular point of view or to be better versions of themselves.
Mm. Do you see that happening more today in history?
That's
do
an
you see a
question.
Definite trend toward more polemics?
I see a trend toward reinterpreting and embracing and arguing with American history. So mm-hmm. I guess the answer to that would be yes.
Yes. How did you try to sort all of these poems into sections? How did you, it's all chronological, but then the sections are your imprimatur. So how did you arrive at that?
Right. Well, so initially it was all chronological. And then I realized that was sort of flat. So within each chapter, the poems are arranged chronologically, but I did mix things up a little because I wanted the poems to sort of spark against one another. Mm. So the first chapter is just the very earliest poets. But then after that, we start mixing it up a little more. So the second chapter is all about the Civil War. And some of those poems were written during wartime, but some of them were actually written long after. and I include all those together. The third chapter is what I call Poets of Moral Persuasion, and that's where some of those poems that you're talking about that sound more
persuasive,
religious, or there are poems about the temperance movement. There are poems about abolitionism. That's where they go. And then the fourth chapter I called Poets of the American Scene. There's was such a an effort in the time periods that we're talking about to use poetry to define what it meant to be American. And then the fifth chapter I call The Rise of the Personal. And those are the poems that are sort of leading into a more modern sense of what we expect literature to be.
I would love to hear one from that section.
Okay.
The Rise of the Personal. That's such an engaging title.
Yeah. So this is a poem by Georgia Douglas Johnson. She was a poet from the Harlem Renaissance period, but was a sort of mentor figure. She was older than a lot of the Harlem Renaissance writers that perhaps people are more familiar with. And she ran a salon in her home all throughout the 20s where all of the younger writers and the older mentors got together. And she was incredibly generous. She made introductions to people. She helped advance their careers. She introduced some of the younger writers to people who could publish them. But she also was extremely well published herself, and I wish she was better known. She's the author of four books of poems, and this is her poem called Prejudice. These fell miasmic rings of mist with ghoulish menace bound, like noose horizons tightening my little world around. They still the souring will to wing, to dance, to speed away, and fling the soul insurgent back into its shell of clay. Beneath encrusted silences, a seething Etna lies, the fire of whose furnaces may sleep, but never dies.
That's a good metaphor for prejudice, the whole poem.
Yes.
Is one good metaphor. You know, Kim, you must teach a course because this is so illuminating. We not only have the poems, the context, the history, the way it fans out in so many directions. Are you planning to teach this as a university course? Or maybe a series of CDs?
I would love to teach this as a university course. I am teaching a course right now, or co-teaching with Terry Ellen Cross Davis for the Folger Shakespeare Library. And that course is on the history of American women poets of color.
I cannot tell you how moved I am to meet these women poets who never would have seen the light of day, Kim. I know that you get immersed in the drudgery of all this, but when you step back from it and look at what you've done, unearthed names that were never known before, I mean, that is holy work, Kim. I hope you got $1 million for this. But if not, we want to hear some more poems. Let's go back to the Civil War.
Okay. This is Grace Greenwood's The Leap from the Long Bridge, An Incident at Washington. And she starts out with this epigraph, "A woman once made her escape from the slave prison, which stands midway between the Capitol and the President's House, and ran for the Long Bridge, crossing the Potomac to the extensive rounds and woodlands of Arlington Place."
Oh.
So the Long Bridge is that she writes about is the site of today's 14th Street Bridge. The Leap from the Long Bridge. No rest for the wretched. The long day is past, and night on yon prison descendeth at last. Now lock up and bolt. Ha, jailer, look here. Who flies like a wild bird escaped from the snare? A woman, a slave, up, out in pursuit, while linger some gleams of the day, Ho, rally thy hunters with halloo and shout to chase down the game and away. A bold race for freedom, on, fugitive, on. Heaven help but the right, and thy freedom is won. How eager she drinks the free air of the plains, every limb, every nerve, every fiber she strains. From Columbia's glorious capital, Columbia's daughter flees to the sanctuary God hath given, the sheltering forest trees.
Huh.
Now she treads the long bridge. Joy lighteth her eye. Beyond her the dense wood and darkening sky. Wild hopes thrill her breast as she neareth the shore. Oh, despair, there are men fast advancing before. Shame, shame on their manhood. They hear, they heed the cry, her flight to stay. And like demon forms, with their outstretched arms, they wait to seize their prey. She pauses. She turns. Ah, will she flee back? Like wolves, her pursuers howl loud on her track. She lifteth to heaven one look of despair. Her anguish breaks forth in one hurried prayer. Hark, her jailers yell like a bloodhound's bay. On the low night wind it sweeps. Now death or the chain. To the stream she turns and she leaps. Oh God, she leaps.
Wow.
The dark and the cold yet merciful wave receives to its bosom the form of the slave. She raises, earth's scenes on her dim vision gleam, but she struggleth not with the strong, rushing stream. And lo, are the death cries her woman's heart gives as she floats adown the river. Faint and more faint grows her drowning voice, and her cries have ceased forever. Now back, jailer, back to thy dungeons again, to swing the red lash and rivet the chain. The form thou wouldst fetter, a valueless clod, the soul thou wouldst barter, returned to her God. She lifts in his light her unmanacled hands. She flees through the darkness no more. To freedom she leaped through drowning and death, and her sorrow and bondage are o'er.
That is an amazing epic poem. It is a brilliant piece of writing, and I had never read it before, and I would never know it if it were not for this book by Broad Potomac Shore. I am so moved and so touched. The voice of Kim Roberts, editor of By Broad Potomac Shore. And I think only the future will tell you, Kim, what a remarkable thing you've given us. You will see, the future is going to make you very famous. And this is The Poet and the Poem, produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family, and additional support by the SciNipid Fund and the Maryland Humanities, and NEH, the National Endowment for the Humanities. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our engineer is Mike Turpin.